Lothar de Larey was one of the youngest police captains on the force, and this was not entirely on account of his father's position and influence. From the time he had been awarded the Sword of Honour at Police College, he had distinguished himself in every field that was considered important by the higher command. He had studied for and passed all his promotion examinations with distinction. A great emphasis was placed on athletic endeavour, and rugby football was the major sport in the police curriculum. It was now almost certain that Lothar would be chosen as an international during the forthcoming tour by the New Zealand All Blacks. He was well liked by both senior officers and peers, and his service record was embellished by an unbroken string of excellent ratings. Added to this, he had shown an unusual aptitude for police work. Neither the plodding monotony of investigation nor the routine of patrol wearied him, and in those sudden eruptions of dangerous and violent action, Lothar had displayed resourcefulness and courage. He had 4 citations on his service record, all of them for successful confrontation with dangerous criminals. He was also the holder of the Police Medal for Gallantry, which he had been awarded after he had shot and killed 2 notorious drug dealers during a foot chase through the Black Township at night, and a single-handed shootout from which he had emerged unscathed. Added to all this was the assessment by his superiors that while himself amenable to discipline, he had the qualities of command and leadership highly developed. Both these were very much Afrikaner characteristics. During the North African campaign against Rommel, General Montgomery, when told that there was a shortage of officer material, had replied, "Nonsense, we've got thousands of South Africans. Each of them is a natural leader. From childhood, they are accustomed to giving orders to the natives." Lothar had been stationed at the Sharpeville Police Station since graduating from police college and had come to know the area intimately. Gradually, he had built up his own network of informers, the basis of all good police work, and through these prostitutes and shebeen owners and petty criminals, he was able to anticipate much of the serious crime and to identify the organisers and perpetrators even before the offence was committed. The higher command of the police force was well aware that the young police captain with illustrious family connections was in a large measure responsible for the fact that the police in the Sharpeville location had, over the past few years, built up a reputation of being one of the most vigorous and active units in the heavily populated industrial triangle that lies between Johannesburg, Pretoria and Vereeniging. In comparison to Greater Soweto, Alexandra or even Drake's Farm, Sharpeville was a small black township. It housed a mere 40,000 or so of all ages, and yet the police raids for illicit liquor and pass offenders were almost a daily routine, and the lists of arrests and convictions, by which the efficiency of any station is judged, were out of all proportion to its size. Much of this industry and dedication to duty was quite correctly attributed to the energy of the young second-in-command. Sharpeville is an adjunct to the town of Vereeniging, where in 1902 the British commander, Lord Kitchener, and the leaders of the Boer commandos negotiated the peace treaty which brought to an end the long, drawn-out and tragic South African war. Vereeniging is situated on the Vaal, which is a river 50 miles south of Johannesburg, and its reasons for existing are the coal and iron deposits which are exploited by ISCOR, the giant state-owned iron and steel corporation. At the turn of the century, the black workers in the steel industry were originally housed in the top location. But as conditions there became totally inadequate and outmoded, a new location was set aside for them in the early 1940s, and named after John Sharp, the mayor, for the time being, of the town of Vereeniging. As the new dwellings in Sharpeville became available, the population was moved down from top location, and although the rents were as high as £2.7/6 a month, the translocations were effected gradually and peaceably. Sharpeville was, in fact, a model township, and though the cottages were the usual box shape, they were all serviced with waterborne sewerage and electricity, and there were all the other amenities, including a cinema, shopping areas and sports facilities, together with their very own police station. in the midst of one of the most comprehensive pieces of social engineering of the 20th century, which was the policy of apartheid in practice. Sharpeville was a remarkable area of calm. All round, hundreds of thousands of people were being moved and regimented and reclassified in accordance with those monumental slabs of legislation, the Group Areas Act and the Population Registration Act. All around, the fledgling leaders of black consciousness and liberation were preaching and exhorting and organizing, but Sharpeville seemed untouched by it all. The white city fathers of Vereeniging pointed out with quite justifiable satisfaction that the communist agitators had been given short shrift in the Sharpeville location and that their black people were law-abiding and peaceful. The figures for serious crime were amongst the lowest in the industrialized section of the Transvaal, and offenders were taken care of with commendable expedition. Even the rent defaulters were evicted from the location in summary fashion, and the local police force was always cooperative and conscientious. When the law was extended to make it obligatory for black women to carry passes as well as their menfolk, and when throughout most of the country this innovation was strenuously resisted, the ladies of Sharpeville presented themselves at the police station in such numbers and in such cooperative spirit that most of them had to be turned away with the injunction to come back later. In early March of 1960, Lothar de la Rey drove his official Land Rover through this stable and law-abiding community, following the wide road across the open space in front of the police station. The cluster of police buildings, in the same austere and utilitarian design as the others in the location, were surrounded by a wire mesh fence about 8 feet tall, but the main gates were standing open and unguarded. Lothar drove through and parked the Land Rover below the flagpole, on which the orange, blue and white national flag floated on a breeze that carried the faint chemical stink of the blast furnaces at the Iskor plant. In the charge office, he was immediately the centre of attention as his men came to congratulate him on the kick that had won the Curry Cup. "Green and gold next," the duty sergeant predicted as he shook Lothar's hand, referring to the colours of the national rugby team jersey. Lothar accepted their admiration with just the right degree of modesty, and then put an end to this breach of discipline and routine. All right, back to work, everybody," he ordered, and went to check the charge book. Where a charge office in Soweto might expect to have 3 or 4 murders and a dozen or so rape cases, there had not been a single Schedule 1 crime committed in Sharpeville during the previous 24 hours, and Lothar nodded with satisfaction and went through to report to his station commander. In the doorway he came to attention and saluted, and the older man nodded and indicated the chair opposite him. "Come in, Lothi, sit down." He rocked his chair onto its back legs and watched Lothar as he removed his uniform cap and gloves. "Buckhat game on Friday," he congratulated him. "Thank you for the tickets, Hellman, that last kick of yours." He felt a stab of envy as he examined his number 2. Lever Lunt. Beloved land, but he looked like a soldier. So tall and straight. The commander glanced down at his own slack guts, and then back at the way the lad wore his uniform on those wide shoulders. You had only to look at him to see his class. It had taken the commander until the age of 40 to gain the rank of captain, and he was resigned to the fact that he would go on pension at the same rank. But this one, near what? He would probably be a general before he was 40. "Well, Lothi," he said heavily, "I'm going to miss you." He smiled at the gleam in those alert but strangely pale yellow eyes. "Yeah, my young friend," he nodded. "Your transfer. You leave us at the end of May." Lothar leaned back in his chair and smiled. He suspected that his own father had been instrumental in keeping him so long on this station. But although it had been increasingly irksome to waste time in this little backwater, his father knew best, and Lothar was grateful for the experience he had gained here. He knew that a policeman only really learns his job on the beat, and he had put in his time. He knew he was a good policeman, and he had proved it to them all. Anybody who might be tempted to attribute his future promotions to his father's influence had only to look at his service record. It was all there. He had paid his dues in full. But now it was time to move on. "Where are they sending me, sir?" "Ach, you lucky dog," the commander shook his head with mock envy. You're going to CID headquarters at Marshall Square. It was the plum. The most sought after, the most prestigious posting that any young officer could hope for. CID headquarters was right in the very nerve centre and heart of the entire force. Lothar knew that from there it would be swift and sure. He would have his general's stars while he was still a young man, and with them the maturity and reputation to make his entry into politics smooth and certain. He could retire from the force on the pension of a general and devote the rest of his life to his country and his folk. He had it all planned. Each step was clear to Lothar. When Dr. Verwoerd went, he knew that his father would be a strong contender to take over the premiership. Perhaps one day there would be a second Minister of Police with the name Delarey, and after that another Delarey at the head of the nation. He knew what he wanted, what road he had to follow, and he knew also that his feet were securely upon that road. "You're being given your chance, Lothie," the commander echoed his own thoughts. "If you take it, you'll go far, very far." "However far it is, sir, I will always remember the help and encouragement that you have given me here at Sharpville." "Ach, enough of that, man. You have a couple of months before you go." The commander was suddenly embarrassed. Neither of them were men who readily displayed their emotions. "Ach, man, let's get down to work. Now, what about this raid tonight? How many men are you going to use?" Lothar had the headlights of the Land Rover switched off, and he drove slowly, for the four-cylinder petrol engine had a distinctive beat that his quarry would pick up at a distance if the vehicle was driven hard. There was a sergeant beside him, and five constables in the rear of the Land Rover, all of them armed with riot batons. In addition, the sergeant had an automatic 12-gauge Greener shotgun, and Lothar wore his sidearm on his Sam Brown belt. They were lightly armed, for this was merely a liquor raid. Sale of alcohol to blacks was strictly controlled and was restricted to the brewing of the traditional cereal-based beer by state-controlled beer halls. The consumption of spirits and wines by blacks was forbidden. But this prohibition caused illicit shebeens to flourish. The profits were too high to be passed by. The liquor was either stolen or purchased from white bottle stores or manufactured by the shebeen owners themselves. These home brews were powerful concoctions, known generally as skokian, and according to the recipe of the individual distiller, could contain anything from methylated spirits to the corpses of poisonous snakes and aborted infants. It was not uncommon for the customers of the shebeens to end up permanently blinded or demented, or occasionally dead. Tonight, Lothar's team was setting out to raid a newly established shebeen which had been in business for only a few weeks. Lothar's information was that it was controlled by a black gang called the Buffaloes. Of course, Lothar was fully aware of the size and scope of the Buffaloes' operations. They were without doubt the largest and most powerful underworld association on the Witwatersrand. It was not known who headed the gang, but there had been hints that it was connected to the African Mine Workers Union and to one of the black political organizations. Certainly it was the most active on the gold mining properties closer to Johannesburg, and in the large black townships such as Soweto and Drake's Farm. Until now they had not been bothered by the Buffaloes here in Sharpville, and for this reason the setting up of a controlled shebeen was alarming. It might herald a determined infiltration of the area, which would almost certainly be followed by a campaign to politicize the local black population, with the resulting protest rallies and boycotts of the bus line and white-owned businesses, and all the other trouble whipped up by the agitators of the African National Congress and the newly formed Pan-Africanist Congress. Lothar was determined to crush it before it spread like a bushfire through his whole area. Above the soft burble of the engine, out there in the darkness, he heard a sharp, double-fluted whistle, and almost immediately it was repeated at a distance, down near the end of the avenue of quiet cottages. "Machtig," Lothar swore softly but bitterly. "They've spotted us." The whistles were the warnings of the shebeen lookouts. He switched on the headlights and gunned the Land Rover. They went hurtling down the narrow street. The shebeen was at the end of the block, in the last cottage hard up against the boundary fence, with a stretch of open veld beyond. As the headlights swept across the front of the cottage, he saw half a dozen dark figures pelting away from it, and others were fighting each other to get out of the front door and leaping from the windows. Lothar swung the Land Rover up over the pavement, through the tiny garden, and braked it into a deliberate and skillfully executed broadside, blocking the front door. "Let's go!" he yelled, and his men flung the doors open and sprang out. They grabbed the bewildered shebeen drinkers, who were trapped between the Land Rover and the cottage wall. As one of them began to resist, he dropped to a practiced swing of a riot baton, and the limp body was bundled into the back of the vehicle. Lothar sprinted around the side of the cottage and caught a woman in his arms as she jumped through the window. He turned her upside down in the air and held onto one ankle as he reached out and seized the arm of the next man through the window. In a single swift motion, he handcuffed the two of them together, wrist to ankle, and left them floundering and falling over each other like a pair of trussed hens. Lothar reached the back door of the cottage and made his first mistake. He seized the handle and jerked the door open. The man had been waiting on the inside, poised and ready. And as the door began to open, he hurled his full weight upon it, and the edge of it crashed into Lothar's chest. The wind was driven from his lungs and hissed up his throat as he went over backwards down the steps, sprawling on the hard, sun-baked earth, and the man leapt clean over him. Lothar caught a glimpse of him against the light and saw that he was young and well-built, lithe and quick as a black cat. Then he was racing away into the darkness, heading for the boundary fence that backed up to the cottage. Lothar rolled over onto his knees and came to his feet. Even with the start the fugitive had, there was nobody who could outrun Lothar in a fair match. He was at the peak of fitness after months of rigorous training for the Currie Cup match and the national trials. But as he started forward, the agony of his empty lungs made him double over and wheeze for breath. Ahead of him, the fleeing figure ducked through a hole in the mesh of the fence, and Lothar fell to his knees and snapped open the holster at his side. 3 months before, he had been runner-up in the police pistol championships at Bloemfontein, but now his aim was unsteady with agony, and the dark figure was merging with the night, quartering away from him. Lothar fired twice, but after each long, bright muzzle flash, there was no thumping impact of bullet into flesh, and the runner was swallowed up by darkness. Lothar slid the weapon back into his holster and fought to fill his lungs. His humiliation was more painful than his injury. Lothar was unaccustomed to failure. He forced himself to get to his feet. None of his men should see him grovelling, and after only a minute, and even though his lungs were still on fire, he went back and dragged his two captives to their feet with unnecessary violence. The woman was stark naked. Obviously she had been entertaining a client in the back bedroom. But now she was wailing tragically. "Shut your mouth, you black cow," he told her, and shoved her through the back door of the cottage. The kitchen had been used as the bar. There were cases of liquor stacked to the ceiling, and the table was piled with a high pyramid of empty tumblers. In the front room, the floor was covered with broken glass and spilled liquor, evidence of the haste with which it had been vacated. And Lothar wondered how so many customers had fitted into a room that size. He had seen at least 20 escape into the night. He shoved the naked prostitute towards one of his black constables. "Take care of her," he ordered, and the man grinned lasciviously and tweaked one of her tawny, melon round breasts. "And none of that," Lothar warned him. He was still angry at the one who had got away, and the constable saw his face and sobered. He led the woman through into the bedroom to find her clothing. Lothar's other men were coming in, each of them leading two or three sorry-looking captives. "Check their passes," Lothar ordered and turned to his sergeant. "All right, Cronier, let's get rid of this stuff." Lothar watched as the cases of liquor were carried out and stacked in front of the cottage. Two of his constables opened them and smashed the bottles against the edge of the curb. The sweet, fruity smell of cheap brandy filled the night, and the gutter ran with the amber-brown liquor. When the last bottle had been destroyed, Lothar nodded at his sergeant. "Okay, Cronier, take them up to the station." And while the prisoners were loaded into the two police trucks that had followed his Land Rover, Lothar went back into the cottage to check that his men had not overlooked anything of importance. In the back room, with its tumbled bed and stained sheets, he opened the single cupboard and distastefully used the point of his riot baton to rummage through it. Beneath the pile of clothing, at the bottom of the cupboard, was a small cardboard carton. Lothar pulled it out and tore open the lid. It was filled with a neat stack of single-leaf pamphlets, and idly he glanced at the top one until its impact struck him. He snatched up the sheet and turned it to the light from the bare bulb in the ceiling. "This is the Poko, of which it is said, 'Take up your spear in your right hand, my beloved people, for the foreigners are looting your land.'" Poko was the military branch of the Pan-Africanist Congress. The word Poko meant pure and untainted, for none other than pure-blooded African Bantu could become members. And Lothar knew it for an organization of young fanatics already responsible for a number of vicious and brutal murders. In the little town of Paarl in the Cape, Poko had marched hundreds strong upon the police station, and when driven back had vented their fury upon the civilian population, massacring two white women, one a girl of 17 years. In the Transkei, they had attacked a road party encampment and murdered the white supervisor and his family in the most atrocious manner. Lothar had seen the police photographs, and his skin crawled at the memory. Poko was a name to fear, and Lothar read the rest of the pamphlet with full attention. It said, "On Monday we are going to face the police. All the people of Sharpeville will be as one on that day. No man or woman will go to his place of work. No man or woman will leave the township by bus or train or taxi. All the people will gather as one and march to the police station. We are going to protest at the past law, which is a terrible burden, too heavy for us to carry. We will make the white police fear us. Any man or woman who does not march with us on Monday will be hunted down. On that day, all the people will be as one. Poko has said this thing. Hear it and obey it." Lothar read the crudely printed pamphlet through again, and then he murmured, "So it has come at last." He picked out the sentence which had offended him most. "We will make the white police fear us." And he read it aloud. "So? Well, we'll see about that." And he shouted for his sergeant to take the carton of subversive leaflets out to the truck.